This is a report of interview with Rear Admiral William M. Landymore, Royal Canadian Navy brackets retired, close the brackets, in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Alma, that's William Moss Landymore. Will you go back and change the title? Bill, I really do appreciate you coming over in your 30-minute drive to see me today.
Not to worry.
I know you didn't want to. You say not to worry, but I do appreciate it, and the historian would appreciate it. So, welcome to my home in the Holiday Inn, and you won't remember the first time I entertained you in my home, but I was a lieutenant, and I think you were a lieutenant commander. And Alma invited us out to our little house in Halifax out there for lunch, and she had a nice fish casserole for us, and as we drove back to work together, you said that was one of the nicest lunches you had ever had, and that was somewhere in the 1940s. So
that's quite a long time
ago. We go back. Another memory I have of you, all my memories of you are fond memories, is I was in Ottawa one day and I saw CNS's car coming with the flag. So I altered, turned left, faced the curb, and saluted as you and CNS went by. CNS returned my salute, but as the car flashed on, you turned around, leaned out the back window, and grinned at me and waved. It's another little memory I have of you. So what we're going to try to do today is try and recapture some of those memories and some of those times. And I'd like to start at your RMC time. Why? What caused you to go to RMC?
I don't know. I was pretty keen as a youngster on military things. I had already joined very young the Dufferin Rifles, which became the Dufferin and Haldimand Rifles. And in 1934, I was a sergeant. And I had done a summer, that particular summer, in Petawawa with the non-permanent active militia.
NPAM, yes.
That's
right,
the
term.
NPAM. Yeah. And I had, but about that time, when I was in my senior matric here at the RMC, at the Brantford Collegiate, I made an application for RMC. And fortunately was accepted.
Were there soldiers in your background or sailors, fathers,
no,
uncles?
No. The only interest in my background given by my family was interest in the sea by my blue-nosed mother, growing up in Lunenburg.
Ah.
She had quite a lot to tell me about what fishermen did. Both Blue Nose, which even those days, nothing matched that in their memories.
Alma's grandfather was one of the shipwrights that built the original Blue Nose. She's from down there. Just
well,
a minute, I want to see.
Job well.
I want to see. So you went to RMC. My father was a CSMI at RMC, maybe just after your time. But he was on the instructional staff there in the 30s.
Well, I went. I started at RMC in September 34 and had it through to June 36.
Yeah, well, I think those were his years, I'm not sure.
And of course, we still have the opportunity, as they have now, to come to the Navy in the summer.
Ah, so in your after your first winter at RMC, did you do summer training?
Yes.
So
joined the reserve.
Yeah. You were RCNVR, you know that?
Of course. Of course.
Seems funny now, doesn't it? I said that to Jimmy Hibbert. He said, I was never in the RCNVR. I said, yes, you were.
He said, well, I made no bones about it. I was delighted to have a summer with the Navy, and we had a marvelous summer, both years. And I see I came down again in 1936 after June, and I didn't join the Navy. And I went over to Britain in August as a cadet in the RCN.
Yeah.
Well, but on loan to the R and for training.
Those two summer trainings, what did you do? Did you
The first year was an introduction to naval life. We had communications exercise, semaphore flag, flashing, and We had a few days of gunnery and a few days of torpedo and mining and a little seamanship thrown in here and there.
Did you get to sea?
No. Second year we did.
What did you go to sea in the second year?
Saguenay.
And who was driving Saguenay?
Oh, my goodness. Now, if you're going to ask me questions...
No, I'm not. Look, these things are in the Navy list.
Yes.
And we can check them, but I just...
Well... It'll come, but later on in, yep, in the discussion, Gus Miles was number one, and Willie Porteous was the engineer. Miff Medland was the son.
Yep.
Budge was the gunner.
Well, let me talk about Budge for a moment. Budge was nearly always given the RMC cadets to train. Budgie was very fond of training. He always... That was his strength.
It had nothing to do with that.
But he didn't have much to do with
you
at some point.
No. Medlin really had the job of keeping us under our wing.
Yeah, yeah. And you went around the Nova Scotia coast, I presume?
We went, we went to Charlottetown and then to Pictou and then up to Montreal. And we were dumped off in Montreal and the ship went on a Vimy pilgrimage. The first of them. H.F. Pullen was attached to the ship just for the pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. That was my first meeting with him. Budgie was there, and he loved to, whenever he could, he'd ask us questions, usually seamanship questions, to which he knew we wouldn't know the answer. Mm-hmm. And then made sure we wouldn't forget.
Yeah,
well, that's Budge, isn't
that's
it?
Budge, that's yeah. Budge, yeah.
Now, he was visiting me the other day. Came down to Halifax and came out, he and his wife and daughter came out and had lunch with us.
That's nice, because I see him only occasionally in Victoria. He doesn't like to move far away from his little respirator, you know, he's having respiratory problems.
Yeah. Well, he's much better, as a matter of fact, at the moment, because I just had a letter from him maybe a week ago, and he's quite a lot better.
Well...
Anyway, that's what we did, and I think that the person who made the biggest impression, Ken Adams, was our sort of officer in charge of our training in Halifax in the first year I was there with the RMC. And then when we went to sea, Miff Medlin was sort of given the job of looking out for us. Hugh Pullen, I think, on board, although he wasn't the ship's officer, took more interest in us than Miff. Because I think Miff was busy trying to get himself a watchkeeping ticket and a few other things.
Yeah.
But there was a rather peculiar incident in the first year. Wag Richardson was teaching us gunnery in the classroom with blackboard and chalk. And I don't know who it was in our group, which consisted of people like Jim Kirkpatrick and Dunn Lantier and Stan Clark. Do you remember these names?
All
Roy
these
Hyman.
Yeah, all these pre-war RCNVRs.
Yeah, they all dressed. Dunn Lantier stayed.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. Well, one of them, I think, didn't take anything very seriously and may have bombarded Richardson with some paper pellets the kind of time somebody can give an instructor. Well, Richardson thought it was me. Now, I didn't even know this was going on. But after a half-hour lecture in the classroom, he took us out and put us on the 6-inch loader. And he thought I'd been riding somehow. I don't know why he thought of me. And... So I was a loading number on a 6-inch loader and picking up a 112-pound brick.
Yeah.
And just as soon as he changed rounds and I got the second loading number, then he'd change rounds, until it came back to me for the loading number again, and he kept this up. And then he got nervous about it.
Why?
Well, because what he was doing would... It's pretty injurious to health if you weren't pretty damn careful and you didn't know what you were doing. And I was just stubborn enough. I realized that I was getting the gears, but I didn't know why I was getting the gears. And I was damned if I'd ever give in to anybody. And he got nervous about it. And a couple of members of the class walked over to him and said, "You've done enough," and stopped him. And he was thankful he'd been stopped. Now, I can tell that story now, but you know, I didn't know the story until last year. And he told me his side of what had happened after we had a gunnery officer's lunch in Stadacona. Wasn't that something? 49 years later. And he went to sea with me as a second G in Uganda.
Yeah.
So that was...
there's lots of interesting things come out 49 years later. I heard some things at that June conference that...
But the business about him, it was he who told me that when I got this thing started, I couldn't get it stopped. I didn't know how to stop it. I was damned if, he said, I was damned if I was going to lose face over it, but I got very nervous because I'd really given you a rotten time. And he said, I was thankful when two members of your class said, "All right, you've done enough now, pack it in."
It was good of them, rather brave of them too, wasn't it?
I don't think anybody needed to be worried about things like that.
Yeah.
We weren't likely to have anybody really ride us too hard. Miff Medlin rode us pretty hard in the following year at sea.
In what way?
Well, an example, we sailed from Charlottetown to Pictou, or we were to have sailed, with Hugh Pullen in charge of the cadets in the boat. And we'd no sooner been lowered and slipped just outside the harbor of Charlottetown in quite a reasonable breeze, and it just dropped absolutely dead. And old oars and pole, down sail, old oars and pole, the old business, and it's 19 miles. And the tides weren't all that favorable, too. And we were still pulling at 9 o'clock at night. This was from early morning. We opened the bully beef, and,
I bet
and
you.
We did, and the hardtack. Yeah. And I remember to this day, this was in 1936, summer of 36. And there was when we opened the box with a biscuit in, it was an airtight tin with a flap lid that had to be pulled away. There was a little paper on the top thing, packaged and packed in 1909. So it had survived World War I and probably just as good as the day they made it, but it wasn't very good at any time.
No. I see what you mean by
that.
Right.
Now then, the following day, we got up at 6 o'clock, and there wasn't one of us who had any flesh left on his backside after this. I mean, we were just raw, the backs of our legs and our bottoms, and our hands were blistered to, you just can't pull an oar like this for that length of time and not suffer, because it's not made to be pulled like that.
Yeah.
And so he got us up the following morning, and he, without any sense at all, took us boat pulling. He should have put us on the jetty and made us run or something like that, but he took us boat.
That was Hugh Pullen.
No, this is Miff Medlin.
Medlin again.
And you could hear, as we were told, you could hear the people cussing him. And just floating quietly enough that he could hear it, but he couldn't really detect who was doing it. But everybody was doing it. And it lasted about 10 minutes, and then he turned around and went back, and that was the end of that. He never tried any funny stuff again, but it was a very silly thing for him to do.
You were all pretty fit from your RMC time, because that was not easy.
Oh,
your RMC year was not easy physically.
Oh, no, we were hard as nails.
Mm-hmm. The I don't know if you used the term hazing at RMC, but the first year men got a pretty bad time of it. This doesn't exist today. What did you think about that kind of almost bullying in the first year?
Uh,
I'm not a very good person to ask that question of, because I had a very easy recruit year. What I did get, I didn't like. But there's a system of what is called ex-recruiting. And anybody who excelled in any sport or made a team got X number of days free of recruiting. Now, that doesn't mean he didn't have to train, he didn't have to work for a senior, but he didn't. For whatever reason they had for doing this, he avoided those situations that got him into the kind of difficulties when the hazing occurred. And I got some points very soon after I arrived for the obstacle race, the recruit obstacle race. And then following that, it was still in the fall, I played football. And God, I don't know how many weeks from that, each game provided me with there was a reason for that too. They didn't want you out doing tracks and being hazed if you're on a team getting, the kind of pounding we got on the football field. Anyway, so I really went through the year with without too much exposure to it. One other thing was that I lived right next door to the battalion sergeant major, for whom nobody at any time, no matter what circumstances, was free of anything. And my roommate, who was Chip Drury, who did very well at the Royal Military College and became my class's BSM, he and I were in this room right next to the door of the suite in which the BSM lived, and he would just come to the door and say in a very quiet voice, "Landy Moore Drury," and that meant he wanted one of us to do something for him. Yeah. He didn't call all the recruits and then give the job to the last one who arrived. But because he did that, we seemed, both of us, Chip Drury did a lot of ex-recruiting because he played football and he did the sort of things I did. We were very well matched as roommates because we were both very sports oriented. We were both on the gymnastic team and football team and the works, you know.
Yeah.
And so Bob Powell, who was the BSM, knew that we weren't doing a hell of a lot of recruiting except working for our own senior. So he used to use us to do his errands for him. But he wasn't the sort of person who was looking for trouble. You know, he wasn't trying to get us into some situation that we couldn't handle and then give us the kind of punishment which is sometimes needed. But some of the cadets suffered horribly, and I didn't think it was fair.
What kind of punishments were meted out to those unfortunates?
Oh, physical torture. An hour bending on the holding rifles out in your arms, wouldn't hold them anymore, bunny hopping, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It was just a miserable way of treating people. I don't think it affected anybody very much. I think some of the chaps were so pitifully unphysical, that it was very hard for them to do anything, let alone do the physical things that was expected of them, so they just got a lot of abuse, really, mouth abuse. Come on, show some guts, this kind of thing. Didn't hurt anybody. Nobody was harmed by it.
That's gone today, I think.
Well, it's probably just as well. I don't think it ever did anybody any harm. And I don't think it did anybody any good, but it was done, and I don't think that working for a senior was bad at all. I think that was excellent, because there were so many things you could learn about how to look after your kit and how to do things that they learned the easy way to do it.
And they taught us and told them, listen, they'd say, this is the way I want you to do it. And we automatically learned how to do things. And when we were in difficulties, they were the first people to bail us out. So,
well, now that's good, isn't it?
Oh, sure. I admired the guy I worked for enormously. I still can't wait to see him when we have a reunion. And so that's the way it is, and I don't think it's all that bad.
Well, it's the principle of look after those that work for you. You might give them hell privately, but if they get into trouble, you stand up for them. I mean, we've all tried
I'm
to
not
observe
talking
that.
About, I'm not talking about getting legitimate hell. I'm talking about...
Yeah.
We're not. I'm not talking about the guy who was late for parade. He bought it. He was going to do pack drill and roll the tennis court with a roller for a couple of hours. That's very good occupation if you want to get some weight off. Yeah. And things like that, but those were legitimate, you know what I'm saying. Then there were these other ones which were sort of just people exerting their sort of wild oats on young people who didn't have any thing. But RMC was I was there 2 years, or two academic years, and twice I left the college ground. Other than for going over in a bus with a team or something like that. But I went into Kingston once each of those 2 years. And on both occasions it was compulsory because we had to call on the homes of the officers who were in charge of us, the regular force officers, and go to tea. Mm-hmm. And I almost invariably chose somebody who lived within the college, so that it was easy to get to, and it was just as good training as going into Kingston. But twice in those 2 years, that's what I went out for. I never had a date, never went to a movie, and but I was so happy in the college. I had so much to do. I just never had a dull moment.
Your academic load was quite high. Well, you never had much trouble with the books, I know that.
I didn't have any trouble, and I didn't work all that hard, because I was doing so much on the sports field, I didn't have time to do too much study. I didn't fail anything.
No.
I was about, I suppose, 20th in my class, and most of the academic subject, but well up in the military subject.
Yeah. You're about due to go to the training cruiser.
That was in August 36, yes.
Which one was it then? Was it Frobisher?
Frobisher.
Yeah. Would you talk about Frobisher as a training cruiser?
Sure. We were one group. You probably talked to the other people. Have you talked to Hennessy and...
Yes.
Wellum?
Yes.
Barclay?
Yes. So
Blake Locke?
Yes. No, not Blake Locke, but talk about...
Oakville. You better go back by Oakville, talk about... Barbara Starkey.
Yeah, Barbara Starkey.
And Murdoch.
Yeah. He's talking about
it. That was our guy.
Now, they've all mentioned the cadet gunner. Would you like to talk about him, Mr. Margot?
Yes, Mr. Marjo. Mr. Marjo is even smaller than I am and slighter. And not only was he a miserable man, but he behaved like one. And I had had many hours with tough sergeant majors on the parade ground, but none was miserable. And I had absolutely no time for Mr. Marjo. Now, I'll give you an example of the kind of man Mr. Marjo was. Every cadet at the Royal Military College is provided with a dispatch box. It's a metal box with a combination lock. None of the drawers in your room can be locked. Your room was never locked, but you had this box and you could lock that, and if you wanted to leave a couple of dollars or something, or two, usually more than I had, but... I left things like that in my dispatch box, and so did the other cadets. Each one had little private box that he kept things in. Well, I took mine with me. There was no reason not to. It was quite a useful sort of thing. And it was on the top of the chest, which I was allocated to in the cadet training ship, and Marjo found it. I sent for me, and he said, "Oh, Landy Moore, you're not allowed to have that kind of box in the cadet training ship." So I didn't say anything. I knew what was coming next. If I couldn't use it, I knew who was going to try to get it. And sure enough, he said, "You'll have to take your things out of that and bring the box to the cadet office where it'll be kept." When I got it there, I had a combination lock. I locked it and just put it in a thing. When I took it in, I just put it down and kept on going. And then they couldn't open it by anything. So they sent for me and said, "You'll have to give us the combination."
Yeah.
By this time, they knew that I knew what was up. But they weren't mad enough to say, "Come on, take it away, it'll be all right." They insisted they get the combination. And that was it. I had to give it to them. And that's what Marjo, the kind of man he was. Now, there was absolutely no reason on earth why I shouldn't have had the box. There was absolutely no reason why they should have had it.
Yeah.
Well, that's a strange thing to talk about. But if you want a measure of a man, you sometimes have something that puts him pretty well in focus, and that put Marjo in focus. But other than that,
well, there's such a thing as
noisy little gunner.
Yeah. There's such a thing as disciplining cadets, and there's such a thing as being unduly oppressive or bullying. I guess he's...
Oh, well, after RMC, that was a swan.
Where did you go in the training cruiser?
The first cruiser went all around UK with one visit to Norway. We went to Bergen.
Yeah.
And then the second cruise we did, we went to the West Indies.
Yeah.
But we had a rather bad time. So
there was that illness.
We got an illness on board, and one cadet died, and a couple of others were paralyzed.
Yeah.
And it was a real...
It was a real scare, yeah.
You know, just if I had been well-versed in naval history then, I would have really understood what it meant by a bloody war and a sickly season. It was the sort of diseases that hit any number of West Indian ships for centuries. Mind you, if we were fortunate, only one died and two or three were injured for life, but it could have gone through the ship just like wildfire.
Can you put a name to it? Nobody else has been able to.
Nobody ever did. In my own mind, I thought it was a form of meningitis.
Yeah. That's what Bob Welland called it. He wasn't sure, but he said he thought it was meningitis. Yeah. You did the work of the hands in the training cruiser.
Yeah.
And that's good training.
Very pleasant job to be a hand in the West Indies. But that first cruise in the North Sea, I can tell you, wasn't any joke. On your hands, holy stoning on every Saturday morning.
Yeah.
6 o'clock when it's really bitter cold and wet.
And the commander was out there with you?
Occasionally. There was always an officer there.
Yeah. But it is good for a man that's going to rise to higher rank to have done the work of a seaman.
Oh, right? No question.
The principle was sound.
No question about.
Yeah.
And it was a very, very good way of learning what had to be done at sea by somebody. You learned how to push a holy stone without working, for example. And you could tell later on when somebody else is pushing a holy stone without working.
Yeah.
And you could learn. There were several of the cadets who were absolutely brilliant at getting all the cushy jobs, and I was never very good at that, I must say. I don't think there was any of us that didn't enjoy the cadet training ship. And somebody mentioned the black troops the other day. Well, we were the black troops, and we had there were three Indian cadets from
One was an engineering cadet, the other two were executive, and one's name was Colla and the other Coley, and we had the Coca-Cola of no time at all. And the eight Chinese and tourists, three New Zealanders, I guess, and a couple of Aussies, and we were all in one. We were all put together.
Yeah.
I think perfectly natural thing to do, saying these guys come from all over the place. Yeah. But we were, I don't think deliberately segregated, but that's what it amounted to. But we were the toughest cadets in the ship. And even the Canadians, who were probably the toughest of the lot, were very, very careful with the Chinese, who could get the blade open on a seaman's knife quicker than lightning.
Yeah. Wonder why the RN trained all the navies of the world used to send their people to the RN in those days, you know. The RN was held in very high esteem throughout the world, and I think the training that was given...
It's the best navy in the world, that's why.
Yeah.
And it would have been the best navy in World War II if they'd kept radar secret to themselves, as it was their secret.
Well, yes, it started there, yeah.
Well, but it was what the RN turned over to the USN, which made it possible by the time they joined the war to have some very, very vast superior armaments over the Japanese.
Well, with their industrial might, of course, they were able to develop it, and they weren't under attack all the time. They could develop it.
They had quite a while to develop it. What, 1942, January was Pearl Harbor, wasn't it?
January 41, yeah.
Yeah.
Or December 41, yeah. January 42. Yeah. December the 6th, I think, 41 was Pearl Harbor. If we're out of it, I'll fix it up.
Anyway, that was I think that the RN was really a very fine navy, and I don't think that there was anybody. The only other people who, I think the U.S. Navy was a very good one too. But probably once they joined the war, a better navy than anybody else. They had so many more ships and so well equipped. And they fought in a reasonable climate. But I can remember all kinds of people and when I went back home on leave saying, you know, what about the USN? Are they better than... And I kept saying, well, there's not much difference. But I know one thing that gives the Royal Navy a real edge. It makes them the best navy in the world. And if they said, what is that? I'd say it's a trade secret. And they thought I was just a kid pulling a leg. But I was in the squadron in HMS Glasgow. And in Sheffield of that squadron, we were testing the first naval radar. It was then called RDF.
Yeah.
And the midshipmen were given quite a lot of information, as much as could be given, and because it was very sensitive.
We'll get on to that. Excuse me.
Yes. Hello, Yogi. I'm very well. I'm glad you're home. I have Bill Landymore at the moment. May I call you back, Yogi? Yes, of course. We will have lunch on Wednesday. All right. I'll keep in touch with you, and I'll see you Wednesday. That's just great. Bye-bye.
Shipmate, I didn't want to just not answer.
We had very, very good officers in charge of us in the cadet training ship in the RN. The chap who had I was a quarterdeckman, so-called, and we had a torpedoman, Lieutenant Commander Pears, and he was a very fine man.
P-E-A-R-S?
P-A-R-E-S. And he really was a fine chap. And I just worshiped the ground he walked on. And it only took him about 48 hours to get this kind of confidence in his cadets. And he was assisted by a fellow called White, Jock White, lieutenant, great big rugger player type, who took me home with him for my first Christmas in England. I had an indoctrination into English country life, brash Canadian, but they treated me very, very hospitably, and it was a wonderful experience for me. Anyway,
excuse me here, though. I think the RN were always very careful who they chose, both chief petty officers and officers, to put in charge of young officers.
Yes.
I think the RN were always very cognizant of, you know, there's a bunch of future admirals in there, and we better give them the best.
Oh, I think there's no doubt about that, and I think the same applies, of course, to Dartmouth and places like the Naval Staff College and... there's no doubt about it. They put a very high priority on training and getting the right people to do it. And that's why it was astonishing to find a man like Marjo mixed up in this lot.
Yes. I found that Captain's RN took a lot of interest in the young gentleman.
Very true. That was especially true of my second time as when I was midshipman. Officers were very good to the midshipmen, and our captain was and wherever we went tried to get things organized so we could go on and see things and have a really nice visit in the places we went to, not just spend our entire time trying to develop the nightclub life.
Yes,
we were pretty good at that too.
Yes, well, you didn't have to be taught that.
No.
Well, let's leave the training cruiser unless there's something else you want to mention. No? You're going to do your big ship time now. Where did you go after the training cruiser?
I went to another cruiser with Emerald, and Bob Welland will have told you about this, and Basher Blakelock is the other one. The three of us went to the East Indies and HMS Emerald, and we were based on Ceylon, Trincomalee, and had two very, very interesting years. Oddly enough, the RN view of the East Indies was something less than professional. The way we got to where we wanted to go as midshipmen, they just put lists on the board of the various places where there were vacancies for cadets to when they became midshipmen, and we put our name down where we thought we would like to go. Well, Welland and Blakelock and I decided we would try to go together, and the others had other choices, but the view taken by all the cadets was that the best place to go was the Mediterranean, because the Mediterranean fleet was the best training ground, and that's where the admirals all came from. And the second best place was the home fleet. And the third best place was the Pacific fleet. And last, and far, far beneath the dignity of anybody with any intelligence, was the East Indies. There were two cruisers in the West Indies, but at that time I don't think there were any vacancies. I don't think any of my class went to the West Indies. I'm not sure, but that was looked upon as the most social of all the areas. And I suppose Canadian boys, thinking they might get home, might have been interested in that. But I can remember my arguments. Look, I'm going to join a Navy which has got two or three destroyers on each coast, and we're not going to do any cruising around the world, so I'm going to see as much as I can while I can. We're not, if we don't know what happens in fleets, it's not going to make too much difference, because we're not going to be in very many of them.
Yeah.
That was the sort of view I had. It wasn't altogether right, but it didn't turn out to be right. But the choice we made, just, we were so much better off in the East Indies than we'd ever been in the home fleet. We had a wonderful life as midshipmen. And the reason for it was that there wasn't a great deal of stress in the
the activities of the ship. So the midshipmen were given far more responsibility. Well, in any home fleet ship or Mediterranean ship in harbor, there was always a lieutenant on the quarterdeck. My goodness, they wouldn't think of, you know, he had his telescope on the flagship half the time, and they were jumping around and wondering whether somebody was going to come past in a barge with a flag flying, and, you know, everybody was always on the, sort of on the edge of a precipice. And I mean it seriously, because eventually I ended up in the home fleet. My goodness, everybody was, had to have eyes in the back of their head, otherwise your pennants were flying. Yeah. So we didn't have any of that, and we had instruction from 9 in the morning till 12:30 every day of our lives, and not only by our professional officer, but by the schoolmaster who taught us mathematics and navigation and so on. Met those kind of things, but it was a very, very well organized educational program. And then at the end of that, each day that we got into our boats and either drove them or we were midshipmen watch on the quarterdeck, and we ran the ship. And we were told, get on with it. There was nothing more. Here's the routine. This is what you've got to see has to be done. And the quartermasters took their orders for us, and we soon learned how to
so
do things.
So you're a midshipman, and you're also the watch
in harbor, and at sea. The con was always turned over to us. Mm. But in Glasgow, I stood at the back of the bridge and made cocoa for the officer of the watch. Yeah. It's a fact. Mm-hmm. There was no room in a fleet with station keeping going on and everybody looking for, you know, for a very high degree of efficiency. They weren't going to hand down these things for the kids to mess up. Yeah. It would be no good to tell the admiral, well, the midshipman did the con, that's why it was a lousy turn.
Yeah. No, the captain's reputation was
not only
stable.
His, but a lot of other people. Yeah. And so the net result was that we really had a lot of responsibility for what we knew, and I think when we joined the home fleet, we were better able to take our place, whether it was on the back of the bridge making cocoa, or whatever it was we did, we did it better than the people who hadn't had any such experience.
Would you talk about your captain in that ship?
Oh, he's a marvelous man. Welland must have told you about him. Gustus Agar? VCDSO?
Yeah.
Fine fellow. Crazy, is it? No, I shouldn't use that word crazy. That's like calling somebody we just called naive.
Let's say eccentric. How, though?
No, he was just an old sea dog.
Yeah.
And he had some pretty strange ideas about certain things and capabilities and very often, his navigator was prepared to rip his hair out by the roots, his own, trying to carry out orders which at times were very, very perilous. But he always found a way around it, and that's what was expected of him. Gustus Agar kicked me down a ladder one day, gave me a push with his boot. So I got in his way, and it couldn't be helped. But as far as I was concerned, but he said use the other ladder, and there wasn't another one. Well, this is the type of thing you had to put up with. But he knew there wasn't another ladder.
No good arguing with the captain.
But yeah, that's right. And if there wasn't another ladder, you found some other way, but don't not to get in his way. But he was very nice, and his and when we went, did Welland tell you about going to Dietlawa in that ship? Not in the ship, but that we were both at the summer camps and in the hills in Ceylon.
Yes. Whoever was driving the car was drunk, Welland said, they knocked down. No, Welland said, let me drive, because it had been a picnic, and whoever had the car had got too deeply into the wine. So Welland was driving back, and he nearly knocked down a local. And Welland felt dreadful about this. He was lying on the road, and Welland went out, reaching in his pocket, trying to compensate him for the discomfort he had caused him, because he had bumped him. And this RN chap jumped out. He said, "Good God." He said, "Don't do that. Don't give him anything. They'll all be throwing themselves in front of our cars." That's Bob's story.
Well, I wasn't present for that episode. I was talking about the rest camp in Dietalawa. Did he tell you about that?
No, not that one.
Oh, well, the RN kept a camp.
Excuse me, where is this place? I've got to find it.
It's up in the hills of Ceylon.
Ceylon.
And it's fairly near Kandy.
Yeah.
But it's on the map.
Yeah. I'll find it then.
And it's in one of the quite well-known tea-growing districts where there are any number of English planters. Mm. And the camp consisted of quite a large area with a 9-hole sand green golf course, tennis courts, a rifle range, a tiny little parade ground with a mast for an ensign to be flown and a Union flag, and very nice wardroom and gunroom quarters. We had dormitory type, very airy dormitories and bureaus and nice bathrooms. And the idea, of course, was that it was to spend a commission in a ship that was just like a bake oven all the time, and it was extremely hot. It was pretty unhealthy, and that there should be a break in this. So when the ships went in for their annual docking in Colombo, they would be out of operations for about 8 weeks. Each part of the watch got 2 weeks in Dietalawa. The sailors I'm talking about now, stokers, everybody. And, you know, two parts port and two parts starboard, and then one of these, each 2 weeks, was up in the camp. And the officers probably only got as much as 2 weeks, because most of them were required during sort of the refitting period to observe what went on for the departments and so on. But the midshipmen were sent up for the whole kit and caboodle. So we had 2 months of absolutely nothing to do but have a good time. We were responsible for training a guard, which did colors every morning, and there were two midshipmen on, first midshipman of the guard and second midshipman of the guard. And we were given a platoon, and we had to teach them how to fire their rifles. And we'd go to the range, and of course it was highly competitive to see who could get the most men in a platoon over the hump to get the marksman qualification, and so on. But those were our duties. And the rest of the time we played tennis, we played field hockey, we played rugger, we played games all day long. And we were the toughest little bunch of monkeys you ever did see. Well, entirely physical life.
Yeah.
There were no dancers or no girls, no anything up there except we had our own gunroom dining place, and we could get a glass of beer or that sort of thing. But there was nothing for us to do except be physical. Now, I didn't realize how tough we were, but every time a new gang came up from the ship of men, we left out challenges for any kind of sport they wanted, and they took us up on everything. And these burly sailors, they could kick a football, and they could kick us around, too. But nobody could get anywhere near us at anything. We were just, maybe for the first half, we looked pretty sick. But the last half, they looked sick, and we looked fine. We could run like mad. Anyway, what I was coming to was that the German cadet cruiser, Bremen, came into Colombo, and all the cadets were taken out of the ship and sent up as guests of the Royal Navy to this camp at the end of the RN section. So we were kept on for another 2 weeks. We had 2 months and 2 weeks in this place. And our job then was to take on the German kids. Well, they had undoubtedly been briefed on the decadence of British officers, for one thing. And everybody was in their thing, it was all Heil Hitler. Everything they did, their officers, when they came into the wardroom,
They did not use the naval salute.
Heil Hitler.
Well, excuse me, what year? What year are we in?
This, we're now in 1937.
Yeah.
And the wardroom fixed that very quickly. They just said, well, look, if you're going to come into the mess and do Heil Hitler, you'll have to stop while we sing God Save the Queen with you, or God Save the King as it was then. Mm-hmm. And so the Germans agreed that that wasn't really too practical, and so the Heil Hitler, and he stopped, and so did the singing the Queen. But we, as midshipmen, were, each one of us had a sport to look after, and all of us had to play in all the sports, and whatever games there were, we had to compete with German cadet teams. And, well, they had been cruising. They hadn't been getting anything more than sort of physical jerks on the quarterdeck. And here we were, just as hard as nails. And there was just no comparison. Even though we weren't as good as some of them at the sport, we could last so much longer that we were very much better. Now, unfortunately for me, I was given the job of allocating the sports people would take. And of course, they all took the ones they liked. I mean, I'd say, who wants to do hockey? And John Roxborough would say, he was the best hockey player. He said, I'll do the hockey, you see. And when it got down to cross-country running and hiking, there were absolutely no takers. So that fell to my... And I was undoubtedly the poorest harrier runner in the gutter, no doubt about it. And probably as less interested in it as anyone could be. Anyway...
But you were fit, and you probably did well.
Well, the first day, we were going to have field hockey or something in the afternoon, so I asked the German cadets if any of them would like to do a run to a place which was about 2.5 miles away and back, and most of it uphill. And about 16 of them came along and said they'd like to do this cross-country run. So I thought, well, this is not a very good start. And I said, well, let's go, and off we went. And I said, well, at least I'm going to look as though I know something about it, and I'm going to set a fast pace to start with and hope that I won't disgrace myself. Well, I set a pace which I considered a bit fast for me, but after about 10 minutes, I looked back, and the nearest one was about a quarter of a mile behind me. So this was just a swan. I could easily slow down and still be a mile ahead at the end, and that's exactly what happened. But that was not because I could run, but because we were in such good physical condition. And this happened at everything. And the only thing we didn't excel at was singing. And they could sing, and believe me, every evening, and there was a beer evening, and everybody drank as much beer pretty much as they liked, the Germans included, and sing songs, and these German boys, they would all sing the most lovely part singing. Yeah. They had all their sea shanties, and the basses, and the tenors, and the rest of it, and they sang beautifully. Oh, with beer in their hand, you know.
Yeah.
And
Student Prince type of thing. Dum, yeah, da 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 dum, da 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 da.
Yeah, well, anyway, it was...
Tell me, how did the Germans take it being beaten by you decadent...
I think that they very, very quickly changed their mind about what they were up against, and they sized us up as being, well, maybe not quite as soft as had been made out. They didn't excel at anything. And it wasn't just a narrow margin. It wasn't a sort of 2-1 score. We really had the fields at our pleasure, whatever it happens to be. We had one game that was played in Dietloa, nowhere else on earth, and it was called All-In Netball. Have you heard of this thing?
Never.
Well, this was designed by midshipmen in Dietloa. And it consisted of playing on a soccer field, and at the end of the field, a post with a basketball net on it, a basketball-type net, was set with a circle around it, which was about a yard in diameter. And at the beginning of the game, the ball was thrown by the referee up in the air, He didn't care where it went. And then the ball could be carried, it could be kicked, it could be thrown forward, it could be thrown backward. The only thing you had to do was stop that ball from being touched down in this little tiny circle. Well, you could imagine what happened when you got near the circle with 10 people defending it.
Yeah.
And defending any way you like except actual fisticuffs.
Yeah.
You know, you could use elbows.
A real melee.
Oh, boy, a real melee. And then if you did touch it down, you still didn't score. You had to then get somewhere near the basket, anywhere you like, with nobody near you, like a basketball foul. But yeah. Remember, it's a rugger ball.
Yeah.
And get it through the basket. If it went through the basket, you got a goal. Well, now, we took on stokers, we took on seamen, we took on officers, we took on... And nobody ever got anywhere near the gun room of beating them at this game. But I can tell you, at the end of it, we were covered with burns, bruises.
Yeah. That sounds like a great game.
Well, we had a lot of fun. But the Germans, of course, were just befuddled.
Yeah.
They'd never seen such a vicious, vicious sport.
Well, there's only one rule.
No rules.
Yes, the one.
No.
Get the ball in the circles. No other rule.
Oh, well, there had to be... When the ball got kicked out of bounds, you had to blow a whistle as they would in football. But there was no rule as far as body contact except for actual fisticuffs. But we had a wonderful time doing that, and this is what we did at the Etlawa. And Welland and Blakelock, of course, were star turns at all the dirty tricks from hockey. So they were very good at it. I wasn't too bad. I played Canadian football, you see, for RMC. It wasn't too bad.
You played Canadian football at RMC, did you? Not rugger?
No, we played a Canadian
Well, you didn't
they
play...
They had a rugger team and they had a soccer team, but I played on their football team.
You must have been in the backfield then.
I was a quarterback.
Yeah, you'd have to be. I mean, you weren't big enough.
In those days, it was a lot different. There wasn't nearly the kind of amount of forward passing and stuff in the game that there is now.
Uh-huh.
And then when I played on the first team, I was end. Can you believe that? 146-pound end?
Well, it's all right as long as you don't get hit.
I got hit often enough, but...
When I weighed 150 pounds playing for St. Mary's University, which used to be over there, we were playing Navy, and Willie Porteous was coming down the field, and I was fullback.
You get him?
Well, I got him, but by God, I don't remember. I was out for about 10 minutes. He was a big man, and the only way to stop him, I couldn't get at his ankles because
he'll just get in front of him. Well, he'll knock you down and go down.
He chopped his knees up in the air, so I went for his middle, and he damn near killed me.
Well,
so
it's
anyway,
a game, isn't it?
It's fun. Did the captain invite you to breakfast? The usual thing?
No.
Did you have meals with him at all?
No. We had, I think everyone was invited to dine with the captain once during the commission.
Mm-hmm.
But that applied to all officers, not just the midshipmen. There was nothing special that way for midshipmen. But you can hardly blame the officers for any lack of attention they paid to one another socially, because everywhere we went, it was flag showing. And there was the ship was fully organized to entertain the British colony and the official colony wherever we went. The whole after end of the ship became a ballroom in the most magnificent way. You know, flower boxes, traffic lights, green light, drink, red light, dance, one in between, finish your drinks or finish your dance, you know. And no officer ever had his own girlfriend. All the visitors had to be danced with. The Williams, the gunroom just had the absolute task of making sure that every lady was invited to dance. No matter how badly we danced, I can tell you, we had to.
Yeah.
And there were no wallflowers. Everybody always had a good time.
Yeah.
And then there was always a children's party.
Yeah.
So the ship was in harbor. When we were cruising, was a very, very social, busy place. And in fact, the sailors had a much better time than the officers, although it looked as though we were having a good time. The officers had to work at this. And the sailors, they would have run ashore and had a whale of a time.
Yeah.
But everybody was very good to the midshipmen. We had nice trips and so on.
Your midshipmen's examinations are coming up.
Oh, well, we were all ready for those. We did an exam every... the chap in charge of our midshipman was the gunnery officer of the ship, and he required every Saturday morning for us to write an examination. Mm-hmm. And every Saturday morning we had one exam on the a full chapter of the seamanship manual. Mm-hmm. By the time the commission was over, we were word perfect in almost everything to do with the manual. Mm-hmm. And we had all had plenty of experience in boats and
and your time in the training ship, too. Did you drive a picket boat?
I didn't see a picket boat until I got back to the Royal Navy, and then I only saw one. No, I drove.
So when did that commission end? When did she come home?
We came home very early in, I think it was early in 1938. We were stalled on the way home. When we came through the Suez Canal, there was a sudden serious outbreak of problems in Palestine. You remember, Britain was the protectorate, and the Jews and the Arabs were doing then just what they're doing now.
Oh, yeah.
And we were sent into Haifa to cool things down, and that's what we did.
You landed an armed party?
Landed almost all the sailors and officers. And trucks were supplied by the army, and they ran patrols, armed patrols. I had a platoon on the top of Mount Carmel to stop all traffic getting into Haifa by road, and there was an area down below us where people might have tried to get into town by some kind of sort of subterfuge. We had that covered, but we were there armed and with bullets and.
Any shooting?
Hmm?
Any shooting?
No, they were throwing. They were not shooting at us. Nobody was interested in us. They were interested in one another. They were still throwing homemade bombs at the Jews coming out of synagogues, and the Jews were throwing them at the Arabs in the marketplace.